Your argument from petition.
May it please the board, Mr. Davis, this is an argument from petition.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Davis, and I represent petitioners Tom and Hattie Davis. This is a real property case dealing with construction of some restrictive covenants. I've asked to hand out a copy of the 10 restrictive covenants pertinent to this subdivision. I believe Mr. Hearn has also had a copy of the covenants handed out, so you have two copies to refer to. Petitioners are subject to a trial court's judgment, which requires them to tear down their house in order to provide 2 inches of additional view on the horizon for the neighboring property. This judgment was affirmed by a divided Court of Civil Appeals. There were 3 opinions written. About the only thing the majority of the Court of Civil Appeals agreed on was to affirm the judgment as to the neighbors. The Court of Civil Appeals did hold that the developer, Austin Corporation, had no standing to seek injunctive relief and dismissed them from the appeal. The developer has not complained of this holding by application of writ of error. It has become final, and the developer is no longer a party to this appeal. Now, the houses involved in this case are located, if I may approach them, are located in Northwest Hills, Subdivision 7, on a horseshoe-type canyon. This is the area where the houses are located, right in here. The Davis' lot is Lot 22, located to the west of the Huey's lot, Lot 21. The edge of the canyon is irregularly shaped, and it falls off more quickly on some lots than it does on the other. In this respect, the Davis' lot is unique in that it has more building area. The canyon falls off much later than on neighboring lots. This is the Davis' lot here. In order to take advantage of this additional building area, the Davises originally planned to build their house 20 feet from the rear plot line. Both lots are subject to 15-foot rear setback restrictions under paragraph 7 of the covenant. The next-door neighbors complained of Davis' proposed plan, and Mr. Davis and Mr. Huey met and discussed the possibility of moving the Davis' house forward a few feet. After purring with his architect, Mr. Davis did decide to move his house forward 5 feet, and the house is presently built 25 feet from the rear plot line and 5 feet from the east side line. Davis submitted his plan to the developer, and in the face of the neighbor's continued objections, the developer refused to approve the plan. He initially demanded that Mr. Davis move his house an additional 30 feet forward with the rear 55 feet from the rear setback line. When Mr. Davis pointed out that this would result in a violation of the front setback line, the developer modified his demand. His final requirement for approval was the house be moved 13 feet forward with the rear 38 feet from the rear plot line and 9 feet from the east sideline. Prior to the first hearing on this case on temporary injunction, the developer never objected to the architectural style of Davis' house or anything else. His only objection was the house was too far back on the lot. This is the only objection he ever gave the Davises. This is the only objection the Davises ever had a chance to remedy, that the house was too far back on the lot and therefore blocked too much of the Huey's view across the Davises' lot. Now, there have been attempts to bolster this position at trial by coming up with additional reasons for why this recusal was given, but the developer still admits that all of his objections could be lumped under placement, and his only complaint with placement is the effect it would have upon the Huey's view across the Davis' lot. Now, the Huey's view of the canyon is not affected. Their view to the south and to the east is not affected. Their only view that is affected is the view to the west across the Davis' lot. They've admitted that any house on Lot 22, the Davis' lot, would affect this view, and the exhibits 3 and 4 show that this view is largely obscured by the Huey's own trees. The crux of this case is, to what extent can a developer use a general approval covenant to restrict a lot owner's free use of his property? Specifically,
can the developer in this case impose 38-foot rear setback line and a 9-foot side setback line on the Davises when they bought with the impression that paragraph 7 of the covenant burdened their lot with a 15-foot rear setback line and a 5-foot setback on any one side? Now, restrictive covenants are strictly scrutinized on the court because they're a restriction on a fee holder's use of his own property, because they affect the alienability of real property. The bottom line behind all these rules of construction, behind all these policy considerations, is notice. Public policy requires that restrictions on real property be written in plainly understandable language, that they be in a buyer's chain of title so that he understands what he is buying when he buys it. A buyer's use of his property should not be subject to parole evidence or subjective fact findings concerning a developer's subjective intent that was not specified in the covenant. Another rule of construction provides that restrictions will not be extended or enlarged by implication or construction to include anything not plainly prohibited. This was the holding of Couch versus Southampton Civic Association, which is cited in our brief. The court in that case made another holding that is directly on point with the developer's contention here, that the phrase residential area of high standards defines his approval power. In Couch, the covenants provided that their purpose was to provide for a high-class subdivision. And the court said, we do not think the expression high class adds any restriction to the use of the property other than the restrictions specifically enumerated. Now, we've also cited cases from various jurisdictions, including Ohio, California, Louisiana, Florida, Michigan, Nebraska, for the proposition that an approval covenant may only be used within a framework or a standard established in the other specific covenants are within the approval covenant itself. Although they cited no contrary authority, respondents have disagreed with this proposition of law, and in fact, the bulk of the arguments between the parties in this case has been over the applicability of the rules of construction and the interpretation of approval covenants and the extent of discretion granted by these covenants. But be that as it may, regardless of the validity of our respective positions on this point, and no matter how broad the power granted under an approval covenant is, courts have imposed certain legal limitations on a developer's use of the approval authority. The first limitation is that the developer cannot use his general approval authority in paragraph 8 to impose more burdensome setback restrictions than those established in paragraph 7. The second limitation is the Davis' plans must have been in violation or have threatened a violation of the covenant or a general scheme before the developer may disapprove. The third limitation is that the developer's approval power must be used to further or implement a general scheme of development that is existing in the subdivision. And a final limitation is the developer's refusal to approve must be reasonable after considering the respective advantages and disadvantages to each party. This first limitation that I referred to, that a developer's approval power in the general paragraph, paragraph 8, cannot override the specific paragraph by imposing more burdensome restrictions than those established in paragraph 7, was recognized by the San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals in Johnson v. Dick. Petitioner's argument on this point was not even addressed by the Court of Civil Appeals, except in the dissenting opinion. Johnson v. Dick made a two-pronged holding. The court said that a general approval covenant may not be used to write new restrictions nor to cancel out existing ones. Now, no one has ever disputed the validity of the rule in Johnson v. Dick. The only dispute has been whether the developer's actions in this instance violated that rule. Now, by referring to the trial court's judgment in paragraph 7, it is clear that the developer has written a new setback restrictions for lot 22, the Davis's lot. Paragraph 7 provides in pertinent part, no structure shall be located nearer than 5 feet to any sideline, nor nearer than 15 feet to the rear plot line. The trial court's judgment provides that any building on Lot 22 may not be nearer than 38 feet to the rear plot line or 9 feet from the east sideline. This clearly writes a new setback limitation for the Davis' lot. It's the same as if paragraph 7 was rewritten to say, except on Lot 22, no house can be built nearer than 38 feet from the rear plot line or 9 feet from the east sideline. In a California case, which is directly in point, Bass v. Helton, the covenants contained a specific provision establishing setback lines and another provision reserving approval power to the developer. In that case, the court said that the setback provision regulated placement and the specific setback provision could not be overridden by the approval covenant. This interpretation also comports with the evidence in this record that establishes that in the ordinary course of the building industry, approval covenants are not used to control setbacks which are specifically established in other covenants. This same rule was recognized by this court on the first appeal as a valid legal theory upon which the trial court's denial of temporary injunction could have been based. And this rule, like all applicable rules, is really just another way to ensure that a lot owner has notice of the restrictions to be imposed on his lot prior to buying his lot. The rule says, in effect, developer can't give with one hand, or in this case, one paragraph, and take away with another. The developer cannot establish a 15-foot restriction in paragraph 7 and then increase those restrictions through the general language of paragraph 8. The second limitation on a developer's approval power is that the Davis' plans must have been in violation or threatened a violation of a covenant or a general scheme. And in the absence of a fact finding that the plans violated the covenants or general scheme, lack of approval alone is an insufficient basis for injunctive relief. That was the holding in Town Place Homeowner Association versus McMahon out of the Houston Court of Civil Appeals. In McMahon, in answer to special issue number 1, the jury recognized that the owner's failure to have approval was technically in violation of the covenant. But the jury refused to find, in special issue number 2, that the home was in substantial and material violation of the restrictions. Based upon this finding, the trial court refused to issue a permanent injunction, and the Court of Civil Appeals affirmed, saying that there must be a distinct and substantial breach of the restrictions before lack of approval will support injunctive relief. The essence of this holding is that a developer can't bootstrap his way into an enforceable violation. He cannot create an enforceable violation by his own wrongful refusal to approve plans that comply with the covenant and with the general scheme in the subdivision. In the present case, it is undisputed that the Davis' house complies with the requirements of paragraphs 1 through 7, and there is no evidence that their house violates any general scheme of development. The evidence establishes that the only general scheme in the subdivision is general compliance with the requirements of paragraphs 1 through 7. The testimony in the exhibit shows that the area is composed of all types of houses with varying styles, colors, materials, and locations, that each house is different, and that there is no consistency in the type or style of houses. In fact, respondents have never alleged or established by evidence or fact-finding any other specific elements of a general scheme. They have only alleged generally that in addition to paragraphs 1 through 7, there is a general scheme of high standards. And despite special exceptions, they have refused to define what high standards means or state the elements of this general scheme. Not only have respondents failed in their burden to establish the existence of any of these various general schemes that they've come up with at various times in the litigation, they have also failed to prove that the Davis' house fails to comply with any such scheme. Respondents have also come up with numerous reasons to justify the developer's refusal to approve. But the fact remains, and the developer admits, that at the time of disapproval, when he was asked for all his reasons for disapproving the plan, The only reason he gave the Davises was that the Davises' house was too far to the rear of the lot and would block too much of the Huey's view across the Davises' lot. The developer still admits that all his complaints could be fall under placement. Respondents should be bound by this one-stated reason. They should not be allowed to demand that the Davises tear down their house because of the Davises' failure to comply with some unstated reason dreamed up in hindsight. The developer has admitted the Davises' house comports with a residential area of high standard, saying that it is nicely designed, but there's nothing about the design, the materials, or its appearance which would detract from a residential area of high standard, that it is designed in a manner that would be welcome in the subdivision, that the house could be built just exactly as planned if moved forward 13 feet and over 4 feet. With regard to the 4-foot movement to the west, there is absolutely no evidence to support a general scheme requiring a house to be built more than 5 feet from any sideline. Paragraph 7 of the covenant allows a builder to build within 5 feet of one sideline. In fact, the Hueys have built their house within 5 feet of their west sideline and are now attempting to force the Davises to move their house over an additional 4 feet to the west. The evidence shows that many of the houses in the area are built within 5 feet of one side. With regard to violation at trial, no one was ever able to point to any specific manner in which the Davises' plans violated the covenant of the general scheme. The only violation complained of was failure to have approval. With respondents taking the position, the developer could use his approval power under paragraph 8 to place additional or new restrictions on each individual lot as he felt appropriate under the circumstances at the time the plans were submitted. This position does not comport with basic property law. A developer cannot use his approval power to create restrictions that are not appearing in the Davises' chain of title. He cannot create new restrictions based upon what he thinks is reasonable in each individual case. A similar contention was rejected on appeal from the Court of Civil Appeals in McMahon. In that case, the developer contended that any requirement for approval imposed by the developer had the same force and effect as a restrictive covenant, even though that requirement was not written into the covenant. Now, among other things, such a rule would violate the rule in Couch v. Southampton, which prohibits extending restrictions to anything not plainly prohibited. Also, such a rule would impose restrictions on a lot owner's lot that he would have no way of knowing at the time he bought the lot. Respondents have also mentioned a general scheme of plan approval. But plan approval is not an element of a general scheme. It is only a means of implementing the general scheme that exists in the subdivision. This was recognized by the court in Johnson v. Dick, and in fact it was recognized by the original Court of Civil Appeals opinion in this case, saying that it was merely a means or a procedure by which the restrictions are to be enforced. Moreover, there is no evidence that the developer has consistently and uniformly approved plans in this subdivision. He has admitted that they don't keep any kind of records out there, and that there are houses out there that he doesn't know whether they've been approved or not. Another flaw in the respondent's attempt to show other than compliance with paragraph 137 is the requirement that any enforceable general scheme must be one that a lot purchaser has notice of at the time he buys the lot. There's no way the Davises could have received notice by reading the covenant that the restrictions on their lot would require them to build their home 38 feet from the rear plot line and 9 feet from the east sideline. The right of approval gives no notice whatsoever of the specific restrictions that will be placed on the Davises' lot, especially when the evidence establishes that within the common practice of the industry, setback covenants and not approval covenants are used to regulate location, and particularly when the original purchaser of Lot 22, Willard Deason, was told that the approval covenant, paragraph 8, was intended only to prevent someone from building trash or junk. The Davises certainly received no notice from the vague phrase residential area of high standards that a developer intended to regulate placement through paragraph 8. The phrase high standards would imply to an ordinary person high quality materials or craftsmanship, a minimum cost or quality of structure, an appearance that the average person wouldn't consider ugly. The developer has admitted that Davis's house has none of these problems and could be built just exactly as is at a different location. The common and ordinary meaning of high standards does not include considerations of location. The developer and the Hughes have admitted that it would be reasonable for a person reading these covenants to think that he could build his house up to 15 feet in the rear and up to 5 feet on any one side. Respondents' positions the developer may use its approval power to impose new restrictions essentially requires a lot owner to pay his money and take his chances that the restrictions imposed on his lot won't make his property useless for the purpose he bought it and for the intention that he bought it for. It would be too expensive to require a tentative approval or tentative submission of plans prior to buying a lot. A prospective purchaser would have to draw and submit plans for every lot he considered buying, and even then, any approval would merely be tentative. Such a procedure was rejected by the Louisiana Court in Lake Forest Incorporated v. Drury, in which the court said the effective development of land could be postponed indefinitely while a potential builder continued time after time to submit new and different plans for approval. Without some guidelines stated in the restriction, a potential builder has no way of ascertaining what, if anything, the developer would approve. Such a restriction is too burdensome and inhibits the free use and development of property. Another requirement of an enforceable general scheme is that it must be imposed on the very first lot sold. It is a general rule of property law that restrictions must attach at the beginning of development and run with the land if they're going to be enforced against a subsequent purchaser. The restrictions cannot arise later based upon what other lot owners do or what the developer seems reasonable at that later date. The developer has admitted that when these covenants were created, there was no intention to prevent a builder from building right up to the 15-foot setback line in the rear. In fact, he's admitted that this is the first occasion in any Northwest Hill subdivision that he has ever refused to approve a plan for a house being too far back on the lot. He has also admitted that the original purchaser of Lot 22 could have built back to the 15-foot setback line when he purchased the lot. His position is that now that other neighbors have come in and chosen to build their house toward the front of their lot, this right has changed, that it changed for the original purchaser and it changed for the Davises. That won't work. The rights involved with real property run with the land. They cannot be changed according to what other lot owners choose to do with their property. This inception requirement is again really just a means to ensure notice. A general scheme created by neighbors' subsequent acts would not be in a lot owner's chain of title and would not run with the land. This point was recognized in a recent San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals case, Wiley v. Shore, where the court held that to change or create restrictions, all neighbors must agree. Some of the lot owners cannot change existing restrictions or impose new ones on a neighbor who is not a party to the agreement. Neither the original lot purchaser nor the Davises ever consented to a general scheme whereby their property rights would be dependent upon neighbors' voluntary acts according to where they chose to build their house. And the Davises certainly never agreed that everyone else in the subdivision can build up to the 15-foot rear plot line and within 5 feet of a side plot line, but that they could not. A final limitation on the developer's approval power is that his refusal to approve the plan must be reasonable. This reasonableness of the developer's actions must be tested by the reason given at the time of disapproval, not by some additional reason created to bolster positions of trial. If the plan did not threaten violation of the covenants or the general scheme, it is unreasonable per se to refuse approval. In addition, the developer, in his approval decision, must consider the relative advantages and disadvantages to all parties. And here, the evidence conclusively establishes that the developer did not do so. He has admitted that he did not even consider any possible disadvantages his requirement might cause the Davises. He said that he did not even investigate the possibility that his requirement for approval would cause the Davises significant problems. The evidence shows that the move would have required additional excavation for the Davises with an increased risk of blasting with the attendant risk of liability. The evidence also shows the Davises' home in its present location has no harmful effect on the other neighbors and cannot even be seen from the house to the east of the Hueys on Lot 20. Finally, the evidence shows that the move of the Davis house would result in only a minimal improvement for the Hueys' view, approximately 2 inches on the horizon looking across the Davis' lot. There's one final prerequisite before the respondents are entitled to a mandatory injunction, and that is the respondents are required to establish that a substantial injury resulted as a result of the Davis' building at their present location compared to the location that the developer demanded. The evidence shows that any house built on the Davis' lot would block the Hueys' view, and that the Davis' home in its present location has no effect on other neighbors. In addition, all the testimony concerning any injury to the Hueys fails to make a distinction between a house not being built at all and the distinction that must be made here, between the house being built where the developer demanded and the house being built where it is located presently. The Court of Civil Appeals held there was no evidence that Davis' home as built would reduce the value of the Hueys' property. At the very least, the evidence presented on this point at trial raised a jury issue on substantial injury. Based upon this present record, the Davises should not be required to tear down their home in order to provide 2 inches of additional view on the horizon across their lot for the next door neighbor. Therefore, the Davises pray that this court reverse the judgment of the lower court and render judgment for the Davises.
Thank you, Counselor.
May it please the court, Mr. Byrne, Mr. Eskew, with an argument to respond to the court.
May it please the court, I assume the court is saving up all of his questions for me, and I hope I can feel them. It's always a pleasure to be here, and it is always indeed an honor. Some of you gentlemen had the distinction of serving on this court when the first Huey versus Davis, or Davis versus Huey, opinion was handed down. Some of you did not. I had the distinction and the help of hopefully being guided by this court in what it wrote in that opinion. And that's the way this case was tried before Judge Jones. And for those of you who were not on the court at that time, I think it would be well to point out that the judge who ordered this mandatory injunction is the very same judge who denied the temporary injunction from which the first appeal was made. And I think that Judge Jones, after hearing all of these facts, and it was 10 days of testimony before a jury, and after considering this jury verdict, as compassionate and as reasonable as he is, took the only recourse left to him as a result of the intentional construction under litigation that was imposed upon this property by the petitioners. Now, if I understand what this court told us the first time around, and if I understand any of the law, I think really the case boils down to two issues. Those two issues first concern the construction of paragraphs 7 and 8 of the restrictive covenants. And Mr. Davis is absolutely right. I asked the clerk to hand out to each of you all a copy, and so now you've got two copies, but I can guarantee you they both say the same thing. And then secondly, whether or not the developer, in trying to protect not only the Hueys' property to the east, but the rest of the houses in the neighborhood, acted reasonably. Now, with respect to paragraph 7 and 8, paragraph 7 simply purports to set out certain maximum or minimum setback lines. It says that no structure shall be located or erected in any lot nearer to the front plot line than 25 feet, nor nearer than 5 feet to the side, and then nearer than 15 feet to the rear. Now, it is the position of the petitioners in this case, and for those of you who have read, and I know you have, the statement of facts, this was reiterated over and over and over throughout the trial of this case, during all of the pretrial hearings, during the hearing on temporary injunction before Judge Roy Walker, that their position simply is, as long as they can fit their structure within the confines prescribed by paragraph 7, that paragraph 8 is absolutely meaningless. Now, that is what they're asking this court to do, and that is to rewrite these covenants. Now, if this court intended that when it wrote the first opinion in Davis versus Huey, or Huey versus Davis, it would have told us that, because you all had before you at that time all of the law, all of the wording of the covenants that you have before it now. But that's not what Judge Johnson told us. You, speaking through him, said, and I'm quoting from page 862 of the original opinion, when you reversed the Austin Court of Civil Appeals and remanded it back to the trial court, this court held, the effect of premature review of the merits accomplished by the Court of Civil Appeals here is to deny the Davises their right to trial by jury. This court will not assume that the evidence taken at a preliminary hearing will be the same as the evidence developed at a full trial on the merits. Now, this court doesn't tell us to go back and try this case before a jury to construe restricted covenants. This court told us then to go back, or told the Davises to go back and try this case before a jury to determine whether or not the refusal of the developer to approve this plot plan as prescribed under paragraph 8 was reasonable or unreasonable. The Davises got their jury trial and they lost it. And now it appears to me we're back up here before you nine gentlemen retrying the fact issues again that has already been determined against them. And this court went further to point out in that opinion, and I'm reading on the same page in subparagraph 8. Second, the trial court could have found as a fact that the developer's action in refusing approval was not reasonable under the circumstances. We went back down and tried the case under the framework that you all had set out for us. And Judge Jones very cautiously and very carefully let the evidence come in, drafted the charge and submitted this case to the jury, and there were two special issues, jury finding against the petitioners on both issues. But if I may direct your attention very briefly to paragraph 8, it says, for the purpose of ensuring the development of the subdivision as a residential area of high standards, the developers, or in the alternative and architectural committee, reserves the right, and I've skipped a few lines to save your all's time, reserves the right to regulate and control the buildings or structures or other improvements placed on each lot. No building, wall, or other structure shall be placed upon such lot until the plan, therefore, and the plot plan have been approved in writing by the developers. Now, that appears to me, gentlemen, to be clear and unambiguous language. Their contention is that as long as they can fit this within the confines of 7, that the developer or the committee has no more authority, jurisdiction, or whatever, tell him what he can do within those confines. He could haul the Queen Mary up there, and if it would fit within these minimum or maximum setback lines, put it on this lot. Now, in this particular case, they have relied since the beginning on Johnson versus Dick. Now, that was a 1966 opinion handed down by the San Antonio Court by Judge Norman that had no writ history. There is no question but that that case is entirely distinguishable from the facts in Davis versus Hewitt. In that case, a subdivision was formed in which certain restrictive covenants were imposed upon the subdivision. Thereafter, the developers of that subdivision amended those restrictive covenants and accepted therefrom certain numbered lots of the original subdivision. And in doing so, they provided certain changes. However, this language with respect to setbacks was what was controlling in that case. And the San Antonio court, speaking through Judge Norville, said, such lots, and I'm talking about the accepted lots now that form the new, revised, amended restrictive covenants. Such lots were not, however, expressly subjected from the minimum setback lines of paragraph 5 of the original restrictions. What happened in that case? One of the owners of the new accepted lots came in and violated the restrictive covenants insofar as setback was concerned. They exceeded them. They got closer. And the San Antonio court held that they couldn't do that because that would have the effect of rewriting the restrictive covenants that imposed those conditions in the first place. And Judge Norville held, the court held, and Judge Norville spoke on page 175, while it is authorized to determine whether or not a proposed structure complies with the general scheme of development adopted for the subdivision, it is not empowered to write new restrictive covenants or limitations, nor to cancel out and obliterate existing ones. Now, what they're asking this court to do is simply obliterate, in my opinion, paragraph 8 of the restrictive covenant, which takes away from the developer or the committee all control over this subdivision. Now, if you gentlemen have time between now and the time you hand down an opinion in this case, if I could simply point out to the court 9 particular photographs which were offered and marked as intervenors exhibits 9 through 16. They show this house out there in its present location.
Are these photographs in evidence?
Yes, sir.
Well, I think we've already looked at them. We've got time there.
Start this in, but if the photographs were taken shortly before trial and immediately before completion of the house.
I think you can assume, counsel, we've already looked at them. No mind seeing them again. But
Your Honor, pardon me.
Sorry.
The photographs, and of course, I'm an adversary, but the photographs show, in my opinion, a one-eyed cyclops hanging off the side of that cliff out there. This was the last undeveloped lot along this ridge. From those photographs, this court now knows that every one of those houses developed along that ridge before the petitioner's home were all built more or less in a line, so that the mid-center eaves of the roofs of those houses lined up uniformly around that ridge. And everybody had more or less the same unrestricted view of that valley. This house sticks out there so that the front eave line of that roof lines up with the center lines of the other roofs. Now that was part of the general scheme that had been policed and put into effect at the time this house and the construction thereof was commenced. And the trial court found, in response to requests for additional findings of fact and conclusions of law, that insofar as the considerations given by the developer in refusing to approve these plot plans, that the developer took these additional factors into consideration. One, the extreme placement of defendant's proposed house upon the lot. Two, the proximity of the house to the home of the plaintiffs. You can see from those photographs, you can barely get your elbow between those two houses there on the east side of the Davis house and the west side of the Huey house. Three, the extreme height, size, and bulk of the house in relation to the building plot and in the context of the established residential area of high standards in which it was proposed to be placed. Four, the adverse effect of the location of the house upon the houses of the neighbors. Five, the overall scheme of the location of the other houses already built in the subdivision and their placement upon their respective lots. And six, the development of the subdivision as a residential area of high standards. Now, as I say, we thought when we retried this case that we had been instructed by this court, insofar as the principles of law were concerned, that the issue was whether or not the developer was reasonable or unreasonable in denying the plot plan as proposed by the petitioners. Now, while petitioners' counsel says if this court affirms the Court of Civil Appeals, it means tearing down the house, that's not quite right. All the developer asked in order to get approval or to give approval of this plot plan, that is where they could place this house on the lot, was simply to move it 4 feet further away from the Hewitt house, move it 4 feet to the west, and move it 13 feet closer to the street. The same plan, the same house, nothing would have been changed. Now, their defense to that before this jury was, to begin with, we wanted off-street parking for 5 cars. When it was discovered that they had off-street parking for 5 cars, under the proposed rearrangement by the developer, they then changed their story and said, no, we made a mistake, we want off-street parking for 7 cars. Their second defense was, we're going to lose some trees if we move it close to the street. Now, these photographs show trees that are right directly in front of the entrance to the garage. The house is built exactly where the petitioners wanted built. The trees have now been removed in order for them to get into their garage. Those are the trees they told the court and the jury below that they would lose if they moved the house 13 feet closer to the street. Now, I don't think that was unreasonable. I think it is a fact issue. This court told us it was in the first opinion. Therefore, we submitted, or Judge Jones submitted, and I've asked the clerk to hand out to each of you all, the only two special issues submitted in this case. And we tried to follow the dogma of Judge Pope by putting as much as we could into one issue and follow Rule 277. That's special issue number one. I hope someday, maybe, Judge Pope will say we at least got it all bundled together in one issue and track what he's been trying to get us to do for years. But that special issue says, or asks, do you find from a preponderance of the evidence that the developer of Northwest Hill, in refusing to approve the Davis plans and plot plan, acted reasonably and in pursuance of a general plan or scheme to ensure the development of the subdivision as a residential area of high standards? Now, you will note that that issue imposes and places the burden of proof upon us, which we assume, and the jury found response to that, we do. I think, actually, the burden is on them to have proven from a preponderance of the evidence that the developer acted unreasonably. But the issue was drafted so as to impose that burden of proof upon the developer. The jury found that he did act reasonably. Now, there are a great deal of instructions in connection with that issue, which we thought, trying to track the law as handed down by this case previously, and the law in this area covered the law insofar as the right of a developer to...